again, everyone. It is Thursday, the 7th of January, 2016. And this is your inaugural, at least for 2016, Access to Access presentation, where you get to ask the questions of guests, all the movers and shakers in, I guess we'll call it our alternative, if you will, financial world. Today's guest is, Chris, I won't embarrass you if I call you the smartest guy I know. Will that embarrass you if I call you that?
Well, as long as you only know one other guy, that's fair.
I should qualify that. I know a bunch of dopes and drunks. So it's not like, you know, I'm putting you in, you know, with Einstein. But nonetheless, you are the smartest guy I know. Chris Martinson, who is the owner, proprietor, editor, whatever you want to call him, of the great Peak Prosperity website. Encourage you to check that out. I encourage you to consider a subscription. The stuff he writes, the information he provides is fantastic. He's also a best-selling author, and his latest book is called Prosper, and it's subtitled How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting, because we all know that his current paradigm has been on its last legs for really quite some time, especially since 2008, and we've got to prepare for what is coming. That's what TFMR is all about, but also create a world worth inheriting. And so what a perfect guest to begin 2016. Chris, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I hope you're well, and welcome back to TFMR.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be back. I'm looking forward to this.
So tell me, my friend, before we get started, I do want to spend some time talking about the book. I think it's fantastic, some of the topics that you've covered in here, but even more specific to just investing, just the topics, you know, the stuff you talk about your living your personal life, you know, living capital, that type of thing, knowledge capital. Tell everybody in your own words, take a minute if you would, and tell them what the book is about and why people should buy it.
Well, of course, I'd be happy to. Now, a lot of people are familiar with my earlier work called The Crash Course. It's in video and book form, and that's really problem definition, right? It's talking about the economy and all the debt levels and how money's created, you know, talking about the energy situation, also the environment. So that problem definition usually leads people to ask the question, well, what should I do? And in the course of several years of running seminars and, you know, running our website, Adam Taggart, who's the co-author on that book, and myself, started to hear the same refrains over and over again, and we were really trying to help people answer that question, like, what should I do? Because it's not as simple as saying, oh, I'll invest a little money in gold and I'm good, right? Because if you really understand the nature of the changes that are coming and the risks that are embedded in our system, there is some fairly large scenarios you might, you know, mentally have to grapple with, such as what would happen if our electricity grid came down or we lost food production for a while or the banking system collapsed. You know, these are not as unthinkable as they were 10, 15 years ago. People are starting to think about them. So that's part one. And then part two is that a lot of people are filled with anxiety about these changes. And that's not just corrosive to their enjoyment of quality of life at this moment, but it will also reduce their ability to really prepare for the future. So we wrote this book to be more about the solution space to address this, what should I do? And, you know, we do spend a big chapter on financial capital. It's probably our longest chapter. There's a lot of things to wrestle with around that. You know, there's new things we have to consider beyond just buying gold and silver. John Corzine at MF Global taught us that, you know, client accounts aren't safe anymore. And the G20 meeting at Brisbane taught us that there are new structural rules that enshrine derivatives as senior claimants to, you know, bank capital and assets during a bank disposition or a fire sale or whatever's going on when they're closing a bank down. You know, so there's new things we have to think about. So we spend a lot of time with that financial capital. But what we say is, listen, if all you have is financial capital, you're still poor. Because the kinds of situations and scenarios we might want to prepare for, we need to have other forms of capital embedded in our life. And by that, I mean things like social capital. So social capital isn't just how many people you know. It's actually how well and how deep you know them. And there are things you can do to really build that social capital beyond just, you know, having a party, seeing people once a year at a potluck or something like that. But there's ways to go about entering the realm of both giving and receiving, because you have to close that loop. If somebody isn't receiving graciously, the giving doesn't really build social capital. Right. So we talk about how to build social capital, and that was sparked by having talked with an author of a book who investigated what happened in Zimbabwe, right? And there were people in Zimbabwe who saw the currency was about to collapse, and they're just like all of your listeners and mine, very on top of it. And these people prepared as best they could, but this wasn't a crisis that was over in 3 months or even 3 years. It was an 8-year burn on that currency. And so the people who prepared, well, no matter how much food, petrol, and gold they set aside, they ran out of all of those. The people who did the best over that long 8-year stretch were those who had deep social connections, so they always knew where to find stuff when nobody else could, and they knew how to have favors both be granted and returned. And so anyway, the building social capital is really important, but not just for the future, but for today. So one of the key determinants of people's happiness today is the depth of their social connections and interactions. So that would be an example of one of the other forms of capital. We say, listen, if you now are rich in both financial capital and social capital, you are far better off than the average person out there. And so I've just gone through two of the 8 forms of capital that are in Prosper.
I think everybody listening is probably thinking, this is a book I need to get. Because as you said, we all think about the present, and we all recognize, if you're a visitor to my side or yours, most of us all recognize what's going on, and we've recognized it now for a number of years. But it's that preparing for this uncertain future that involves a lot more than just simply stacking some gold and silver in your safe. And boy, what a great handbook for taking those steps.
Well, thank you for that. And absolutely, you know, we think that there are just absolute fabulous benefits to stepping into each of these 8 forms of capital. And here's the fun part, I guess. So both Adam and myself, we're not just writing the book. Every single thing in there we've already done in our own lives. This is very much we believe in integrity and walking the talk. So when I write about living capital, I say, hey, you know, living capital is both my body and also the living systems outside of my home, site. So, you know, it's the garden, it's the water, it's all those things. I don't just say the obvious things like, oh, yeah, you should be in shape and it'd be great if you had a garden. I've done all of those things. And so I've taken a good chunk of my financial capital and I've bought compost with it and put it in an orchard and built up my soil. And I use the very best data I can to understand how to make myself healthier as well. So those things are adding huge benefits to my life right now. And I would be doing these things anyway, even if I wasn't worried about something coming in the future. So I guess I'm saying there's a little carrot, little stick. The stick is, oh my gosh, what if the future goes bad? What if the financial markets really crack? You know, then what? But as well, there's the carrot, which is, I got to tell you, I have a very high quality of life right now, and I'm going to continue living that way. So this book, Prosper, we put that sort of upbeat title there because we're not here to do the whole hair shirt, you know, it's time to go live in the bunker in Idaho kind of a moment. We're here saying, look, nobody knows how the future is going to turn out, but why wouldn't you live your life as fulfilled and as happy as you possibly can today? But if you can do that and be making yourself more resilient for the future, that feels like a really winning combination to us.
Well, and there's 13 chapters. You should have added a 14th chapter, which is Craig's plan. is that I'm going to move right next door to you. And then that way, I hope, you know, I can pick at your orchard and that kind of drink some of your water. That would be, I think, the best plan. Now, it's a fabulous book. And again, I want to give it a big thumbs up and encourage everybody to check it out. You find a link to the book, send you to Amazon right here on this podcast page. So please check it out. And again, as we get started with some questions, I've got one I want to address just in terms of what's going on right here in the here and now in early 2016. But again, we do this format in this GoToWebinar platform so that anybody listening wants to add a question that we can ask Chris really on any of these topics, you just type it in on your under the questions tab on your GoToWebinar control panel and I'll forward it on to him. So as you're listening to these answers, there's anything you want to ask Chris, just type it in and we'll get to them here in just a minute. But to begin with, Chris, we are seeing some serious issues in the global financial markets again here in early January. We saw these all rear up back in August when the Chinese were rapidly devaluing the yuan and dollar yen started to go straight down and took the stock market with it. And under the cover of that, the Chinese managed to liquidate, I think the total number might have been about $90 billion in U.S. treasuries, without really moving the needle on interest rates. You know, people have said for really decades that we had them right where we wanted, that they couldn't liquidate treasuries without hurting themselves, you know, because it would crush bond prices and all that kind of stuff. Well, wait a second. They liquidated 10% of their treasury holdings back in August, and it didn't move the needle. And now it seems like they're doing it again. Just want to kind of get your thoughts on where we are here starting the 2016. Gold's up about 4% on the year already, and the stock market's down about 4%. And what are your thoughts here as the year begins to unfold, Chris?
Well, it's the same set of thoughts I had back in August, and I'm glad you're connecting it to that, because that was a very seminal teaching moment that happened. So on August 10th, you know, the yuan was sitting at a certain level, and 2 days later it was sitting at a very different level. And what happened was the Chinese authorities underwent a surprise, emphasis on the word surprise, devaluation. And what happened was it caught a lot of computers off guard. And we know that by, you know, just within a week, you know, the U.S. market had really cratered and the Chinese market had cratered. There were all these ripples that happened all over the world. And you might ask, well, so what? So they devalued the yuan. It was a little surprising, but it was just under 4% devaluation. You know, big whoop, right? Well, what happened was, is this isn't your daddy's market. Anybody who studies markets now knows that. You know, if somebody says, Chris, why did gold go down? I say, well, let me check what happened with the yen, and then let me see what happened with the Nikkei, and then the euro-yen cross, and I can probably tell you, because there are all these big, giant hedge funds and computers that are just trading these arbitrage pairs. They're doing correlation pair trades, not all of them, but enough of them, that when a correlation pair trade breaks, these computers just close up literally in the blink of an eye. All the volume disappears. And the so-called liquidity of our markets has proven to be just completely false.
Yeah.
And once one of them closes up shop, there's this big network ripple effect. So, you know, it's one of those, you know, the butterfly beats its wings and you get a hurricane somewhere else kind of stories. But, yeah, the Chinese yuan was devalued on August 10th, and within 15 days we had this carnage all over the place. And so, you know, fast forward, what happened to start the year? Well, the Chinese stock market got the headlines. It was down 7% on the first day of the year, January 1st. But what also happened was that the yuan had another surprise little bump down. And what's happening there is that the Chinese officials are really struggling with the idea that they want a lower yuan price, no question about it. They would love to export their deflation to the rest of the world. They're willing to take the pain of importing inflation, but, you know, at least they'll be able to continue their export manufacturing miracle. So goes the story. So there have been a number of devaluations that have happened. There have been three now between the first and now today is the seventh of the year. And each one of those has been accompanied with market disruptions. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced that those market disruptions isn't because a guy like you or me is sitting down going, oh, my goodness, the yuan just went down another 1%. I better sell everything. Right? It's because of these computers that run everything. Thank you, Federal Reserve. Thank you, ECB, for all your beneficence and absolutely stoking the largest, most speculative set of bubbles in the world. Thank you, SEC, for never regulating the HFTs and allowing them to achieve full market dominance, 99% of all quotes, a significant fraction of all the volume, to the point that, you know, I'm an old E-mini trader. I used to trade futures a lot, gold and silver. I haven't traded since 2008 because I can't. I don't know how to trade against these computers.
Right.
And guess what? I'm not the only person that's come to that conclusion. You look at futures volume traded on the CME, and it peaked out in 2008 and has just been absolutely cratering ever since because nobody wants to play against these machines. And so that's the world we live in. So, yeah, if that sounds a little bit fragile and dangerous to you, it's because it is. And we're experiencing that right now. And my prediction is we're going to see a lot more of it in 2016.
Yeah, and I've been writing about since early August about the way it appeared that the general trend in the S&P had rolled over again, just like it had in 2000 and 2008. And boy, everything's falling into line. The patterns are tracking just as they did in 2001 and then 2008. And boy, those previous market collapses were nearly 50%. There are a lot of folks out there that certainly can't stomach another 50% drop. And, you know, the old joke about the 401k becoming the 201k. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot asking, you know, have you provide investment advice and that kind of thing. But I mean, for folks that are out there that just can't stomach, you know, they're too close to retirement age, that kind of thing. they can't stomach another 50% drop in the S&P. What should folks be thinking about doing? Are you comfortable answering that?
I am in general terms, and it's okay. Safety. We have a firm that we work with that we help direct clients to if they're not happy with their financial advice that they're getting, and I have a registered investment advisory to perform that function. And listen, it's very clear this is a period to be worried about return of capital, not return on. It's been very hard to sit on the sidelines. It takes an incredible amount of discipline to sit on the sidelines while, the market's making all-time new highs and seemingly, has no stopping point. But 2000 and 2007 should have taught everybody, should have, some people didn't get the memo, that, you don't want to be a hero at the end of a long run. It's better to just, you'd rather be a year early than a day late to that story, because not only can these markets fall a lot from these levels, but they could do it quite rapidly, quite viciously. We've seen flash crashes happen over and over again. The market structure is volatile and dangerous. And, by the way, I think the NYSE is going to be doing away with limit and stop orders soon, so you won't even be able to, put any protection under your 401k to prevent it from becoming a 201k. So everything's going to have to be actively managed, and if you're not the person that's going to sit there literally 24/7 babysitting your account, you got to have somebody who knows how to protect a portfolio. And so the broad outlines of this would be: cash is a legitimate position. Be heavy in cash at this point in time. If you have to have stuff left in equities, make sure they're protected. Do the whole put call selling and buying.
Yeah.
And thirdly, you have to have some money parked into precious metals. And I don't have to tell your listeners about this, but supply fundamentals and demand fundamentals will soon come back to the fore. They have to. They just have to at some point. But right now, gold is still fully in the grips of the paper market. It's still in the grips of the computers that just know it makes sense. Of course, when the dollar goes up, I sell gold and I, whatever. So that silliness is going on as gold is literally not just tiptoeing but stampeding out of the Western vaults. And people are going to look back and go, how did we not see that coming? Yeah. But of course, lots of people have seen that. So those are the three big legs we've got. Protect the equities that you do have. Make sure you got plenty of cash. Have gold. And by the way, there's a whole bunch of bonds I would touch with a 10-foot pole right now.
Yeah, well, that's for sure, too. We've talked about that quite a bit. I would imagine, and I can't recall if you've written about this or not, because you've written some wonderful things on gold that we've posted as guest posts. But this whole junk bond thing, it reminds me a lot of the CDOs and the CMOs back in 2007 that were being, there were regular investors that ended up buying those bonds and funds of those bonds as they were searching for yield, just grasping at yield. And now there are the same regular investors that own junk bonds of companies that are going broke that should never have bought them in the first place, never should have been offered to them. But yet, in a search for yield, they end up owning these things. And we've already seen some funds close down. Gosh only knows what lies in store for 2016. No doubt about that.
Well, and it would not just close down, but the Third Avenue bond fund that shut down, that's an open-ended mutual fund. The key tenet of an open-ended mutual fund is you can redeem the shares at any time. That's why they're open.
Yep.
So that was a big warning sign right there. But I think if we wanted to see the silliness in the junk bond space, we could do no worse than to look at what's happening with the shale drillers. And these were companies that were not making any money as an industry when oil was over $100 a barrel. And oil collapsed hard. And in 2015, in the first half, they raised over $40 billion of new debt capital and another $50 or $60 billion of brand new equity capital.
Incredible.
I'm like, who is buying this? And in particular, who's buying the equity side of this thing? It was Pioneer Resources just 3 days ago floated off another 12 million shares at $117 a share for taking $1.4 billion. And this company they told us flat out they're going to use it to continue drilling in places that we know they're losing money. And still people ponied right up and said, hey, another 1.4, here you go. That just tells you how silly this all is. And I will tell you flat out that a lot of investors in the shale space, both the debt and the equity side, are going to lose pretty much everything
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, and that's all part of the story that's going to play out this year, no doubt about it. No time like the present to be what we call situationally aware and paying attention. Now, no whistling past the graveyard in 2016. I've got a handful of questions already coming in for you, Chris. If you're ready, I'll begin to transition to the stuff that's in the queue. Again, if you have a question for Chris, really about any of the topics that he writes about, the things we discuss, just type them into the dialogue box on your GoToWebinar control panel. The first one, though, is emailed to me. I've got one of them that was emailed to me ahead of time because this gentleman didn't think he'd be able to join us. And it has to do with food production. Again, you talked about, being self-sustainable, taking a lot of this responsibility onto yourself and not just waiting for the shelves to be restocked at your local supermarket in times of crisis. Anyway, this comes from one of our buddies, Gaz. Gaz wants to know, he says he appreciates your work, especially your emphasis on your own personal food production, both in terms of producing your own high-quality food, but also surrounding yourself with the beauty of vegetation. I think the mental health value is very important and very underrated. So Gaz wants to know, have you ever quantified what amount of food someone can produce on a patio garden? For example, do you think that's 1 week worth of food, 2 weeks worth of food, so on? Because Gaz lives in an apartment, figures a lot of folks do, especially if you're in a big city. A lot of folks in my audience and yours perhaps might be in the same situation. So anyway, have you ever really thought about how to maximize a limited amount of square footage?
Well, the first thing is that you're never going to grow a serious percentage on a patio. It's just a square foot problem.
Right.
But of certain types of things, you could grow a very high percentage. So herbs and other spices and things like that. You might be able to take care of 100% of your rosemary and thyme needs if you use those in cooking. But the most important thing, Gaz, and for anybody else in this situation, is to just begin to close the loop between the soil and your food and you. And that's an important thing to do, whether you're growing one, patio tomato and one pot of oregano. Even just doing that is a huge improvement to your life and closing that circle, particularly if you have children as well, to just teach them. Like, that's essential knowledge to have that circle be closed up. And if I was in that situation, I would still travel as minimally far as I needed to find a farmer somewhere that was growing, and growing in a way that was really supportive and nurturing of the soil and the natural world. Because we know now that organic is great. It's a good first step. If all you can do is buy organic, I would do that, not just because you don't want pesticides in your food necessarily, but because if they're farming organically, they're not using GMO foods, and they're not using these pesticides that are going to be harming the bees and the butterflies and the things we absolutely need out there in the natural world. But we can go one step further than that, and there are people who are now farming in ways that are regenerative to the soil. So the soil will increase its carbon matter every year as a consequence. The macro and micronutrients are increasing. The soil depth is increasing. That's a possible way to farm now as well. And that means that when you're farming that way, you are actually increasing the resilience and abundance of the world around us, not strip mining it. And unfortunately, it's still possible to farm organically, air quotes, while still fundamentally strip mining things. It simply means you've adhered to a USDA guideline set of things, which, guess what, sort of got hijacked and are no longer as complete as they might be, but it's a great first step. But it's not, I think we can go further now, and thankfully there are lots and lots of bright, shiny young people who are really bringing their intelligence to farming in this more comprehensive way, and it's just fabulous to see.
Strip mining is a good way to put it. I had no idea that was possible. Well, spending too much time behind my MacBook screen, I guess. That's fantastic that the ways have been developed to actually replenish the soil as you grow. That's terrific.
Oh, yeah. I went out and interviewed them first, and then went, and when I had the chance when I was out in Sebastopol, I did a tour of Singing Frogs Farm. We've got a podcast up on my site with Paul and Elizabeth Kaiser, who run that. And it was the most astonishing thing to set foot. They're on 8 acres. They're grossing about $100,000 per acre. They practice a type of no-till farming where they never pull plants out of the ground. I've been farming 30 years. I immediately changed how I farm. So it's called chop and drop. I just cut things off. You leave the roots intact, and you chop the top of the plant off. Mm-hmm. And it preserves the soil structure. And they measurably, and they're big scientists, so they measured the organic load, the microbiological load of their soil, and they're just off the charts compared to anything I had ever seen numerically, just astonishing. So, and while I was there, I counted over 30 species of birds, rare ones too, sort of top apex ones, killdeer, night herons, like really sort of fragile ones. And so they were just, the whole place was just humming with life, and they were earning more money. They were having their people work 40-hour weeks, not that crazy 80-hour week thing that a lot of people do in farming because, you know, it's harvest right. season. And they were getting full year-round harvest, so they didn't have to rebuild their client base every spring because they lost them for the winter. I mean, it was just brilliant and smart, and it's available. And that's an example of the things we can do if we choose to.
Yeah, yeah. That's fabulous. That's tremendous. Where did you find those folks? Where's that farm?
That farm's in Sebastopol, California, which is north of San Francisco.
Got it. That's really cool. All right. The first couple of questions I have in queue have to deal with your opinion on silver. And I'm looking at this as your producer, editor, and host, trying to figure out if there's a way I can combine them into one. And I think all I can really do, Chris, is read them to you. I'll let you pick them
all. All right. That sounds good.
How you'd like to address it. They come from two separate people, one from Jill and one from Gary. Like I said, I'll read them both, and then you can go from there. Jill's question is, in the past, Chris has identified himself as a fan of silver in addition to gold. Jill's wondering if you're familiar with the whole FOA and FOFOA disdain for anything other than gold, and whether you reject this idea that gold's going to go way up and silver is going to basically go to nothing or stay where it is. Conversely, do you see an eventual sub 20-to-1 gold-silver ratio as an attainable level? Now, that then dovetails into Gary's question, which he said, I know you love silver and made it very clear what you think that is very undervalued, but you don't necessarily see silver as money. I don't know if that's true or not. So anyway, I'll let you pick it up from there and address both of those questions.
Great. Great questions. You know, when I first started buying gold and silver, that was like one word to me. Gold and silver, right? And it's not one word anymore. They're two separate words, and I actually own them for separate reasons at this point in time. One is a insurance policy against, you know, systemic crisis, and the option value of the potential return to a gold standard. So that's gold, and then silver for me is my bet that, you know, as hard as the times are that we're about to go through financially and all of that, that there will be a future and there will be a recovery. And silver is, the more I study it, the more I fall in love with it, both for supply reasons. I mean, you look at where silver comes from, and the number of pure silver mines out there, the grams per ton is just falling, and you know, within my lifetime, if I live to a ripe old age, we will see complete depletion of all known pure silver mines, and then it'll really just be a byproduct of base metal mining at that point. Meanwhile, you look at the demand side and you look at the growing levels of industrial uses, whether it's in cell phones or solar this or, you know, antimicrobial paints that, or it's woven into fibers or bearings on jet engines, it doesn't matter. It's being used more and more, and it's not a substitutable item. It's not like, you know, we're like, well, we didn't feel like using silver today, we'll just use tin. You know, it doesn't work that way.
So,
you know, silver has really caught my attention as something that if you gave me just one investment, it's my Rip Van Winkle investment, and you said, Chris, you just get to pick one thing, but in 20 years, your as-yet-unborn grandchildren are either going to have to live with it or die by it, I would pick silver out of everything that I know about at this point, because I'm absolutely convinced it has a role to play in everything from healthcare to electronics to alternative energy, you name it. And I'm really happy with that. And the second thing is, you know, across both of those is that we're going to be seeing pretty pinched supplies going forward for both gold and silver because of the destruction in the mining industry. You know, if you pull up a chart of the GDX or you know, HUI or whatever you want to look at, the destruction financially is easy to see. But if you pick up a phone and talk to these people who are running these mines, it's really a disaster. You know, they high-graded everything they could. Their costs to mine are still very elevated after many years of high inflation in that business because of energy costs, steel costs, labor costs, you name it. They were not experiencing 2% inflation. And so they've got very high cost structure. They've got falling mine yields and, you know, obviously a depressed commodity price at this point. And so we are setting ourselves up now for what's going to be a pretty good reversal from fundamental standpoint. And here's the fun thing, or the unfun thing about bubbles, which everybody knows. Prices can get heavily distorted on both the way up and the way down in bubbles and stay that way for a long time. So we are really, I think, in a hyper-depressed state for commodities in general right now. It's going to just crush a lot of things, not just in gold and silver, but the poor oil producers. Nobody is making money at 32 or 33 bucks a barrel, whatever it is at this moment when we're speaking. But we're going to see a big wipeout in the farm side as well because of elevated farm debt levels and falling commodity prices. So it's just, I just think we're just going to see an astonishing amount of destruction in the entire commodity space. And I, unfortunately, gold and silver aren't commodities to me. They don't operate that way. And by the way, oil isn't either. Those are what I consider to be fundamentally irreplaceable, valuable things that have their functions that are not substitutable, So that's kind of my view on that. And I will tell you that, if anybody hasn't seen it, Grant Williams has a really great piece out on gold called Nobody Cares. Super well-produced video. I think it came out recently. Check that out. He's just does a fabulous job of explaining how in the West nobody cares about gold right now, at least from the institutional level, but that will change. And when it does, then everybody will care and it'll be a totally different universe. So I still think this is a great time to be buying these things, even knowing there's a good chance they could go lower in price from here.
Yeah. I mean, as long as we're still dealing with paper, and paper can be traded by computer, and that's how we're somehow determining the price of these physical assets. Yeah.
Yep.
Anything could happen. I do want to dovetail that, though, into the next question that I had, because it does have to do with the oil price. This comes from Chuck, and just simply wants to know what you think. I would add, because I've been trying to point this out to everybody on my site, so this gives me a good chance to do it. We put on a monthly close back last Thursday, December 31st, closed the year, but also closed the month. First monthly close below $40 a barrel since June of 2004. We dipped below 40 back during the financial crisis, three separate months in a row, but we always managed to close back above 40, but not back in December. Doesn't make me real optimistic. Chuck wants to know what you think. Are we going to crash further? I mean, what are your thoughts on oil and energy?
Yeah, we're going to go down further from here, and the reason is not because this is a fair price for oil or any of that. The as far as the data I have says, the world's above ground supplies are just brimming, and that's a function of two things. All of the producers who could produce, perversely, they have an increased incentive to pump when prices go down, because they're trying to make it up on volume, right? Yeah. So, Russia's pumping flat out, Saudi Arabia's pumping flat out, but so is everybody, including everybody's like, wow, these shale drillers, so resilient. Look how the volumes haven't fallen off. Well, what they've done is they've opened those wells up, they've widened the chokes, because they're just trying to survive. And the lower the price of oil goes, the more they try and squeeze out today just to keep the cash flows going so they can service their debt so they don't go belly up. And so it's a dynamic in the oil business. It's important to understand that as prices go down, often supply goes up. And the other part of this is that demand is a lot weaker than advertised, and so we've been seeing all of this build up, and oil is extremely inelastic. When you get to the moment where you can't store that last barrel, the price literally can go to zero in that moment, or very, very, very low, right? Because it has, there's nowhere to put it. So what do you do with it? And it's very hard to deal with oil that you can't do anything with. And many of these wells cannot be shut in. You don't just turn them off and say, we'll just shut it down. Wells keep pumping if they're under pressure. So understanding all of that dynamic is essential. And if we get into what I think we're about to get into, which is a capital D sort of a depression across the globe, not just Greece. I think we'll all be joining Greece to some extent. But China's story is over. We've been talking about that on my site for a while. Electricity production is down, imports are down, exports are down, everything says manufacturing recession. They've got monstrous amounts of debt. China has been the number one story, bar none, in terms of increased oil demand over time. If we take that leg of the stool out from this, I could easily see, even if they just flatten their demand out from here for a period of time, we will see a severe problem with oil storage probably in about 2 to 3 months is when it looks like it's coming to a head. So if that happens, could oil go lower? Absolutely. So I'm not catching any falling knives at this point, but I am assembling a list of things, companies that I would be very interested in owning somewhere near, closer to what I think the bottom is. And by the way, I'm no knife catcher. I will wait for things to clearly rebound and go the other direction before trying to get in on that. So, but I do think that some of the best investments we're going to see going forward are going to be oil companies that have survived this, obviously, so we still want to see who survives. And the reason for that is that you need to understand something. From 2005 to 2014, the world spent almost $4 trillion trying to get more oil out of the ground, and we basically have almost the same amount coming out of the ground, you know, across that span of time. So it took almost $4 trillion to keep things about equal in terms of output. Well, in the last year and a half, we've seen about $1 trillion of what are called FIDs, the final investment decisions, and the big oil companies get deferred, delayed, or absolutely just demolished. So we're not investing in the infill drilling, the new field exploration, even drilling out the fields that we already know are there. That is not happening. So that means in 2 or 3 years, supply is going to be down from where it currently is, and that's the moment I would expect whatever rebound we're going to be in to also be in full swing. That, to me, is a perfect storm for much, much higher prices in the future. But, you know, this is the bigger part of the story. The economy with $200 trillion in debt can't afford high oil prices, so it gets killed by them. And the oil companies can't afford low oil prices, so they get killed by that. Those two numbers are getting closer and closer together, what the economy can afford and what the oil companies need. And I think within 4 or 5 years, with those numbers practically touch, unless something really changes in this story.
Who knows what the world's going to look like in 4 or 5 years, too.
So I don't know.
Yeah, hard to say.
That's where Prosper comes in.
That's right. That's right. Okay. You mentioned some oil companies you might have an interest in eventually. Ted's question is, are there any mining stocks, gold mining, silver mining stocks that you have an interest in, or do you just avoid that sector altogether?
I haven't been in that sector since late 2010. And so I'm really behind the curve. But, you know, I would pick off, if I had to dust it all off again, obviously I'm going to look for the usual things, right? Companies who've got the best balance sheets, good management teams. I'm really looking for ones that don't have geopolitical risk, because I'm convinced that when this next big crisis comes, we're going to see a lot of nationalization. You know, I wouldn't touch anything in who's got like a heavy-duty South American presence at this point, et cetera, and so forth. So I am really kind of partial to the Canadian producers and other places that I trust more. So that would be potentially part of the story going forward. But I'm not there yet. I'm still waiting for the dust to settle a little. Because even if gold goes up and the stock market crashes further, you're still going to see further weakness in the mining shares at that point, probably, because they're just exposed to the market like anything else. They've got beta. So
they are equities, by the way. That is what I get that all the time. You know, the stock market's down 400 points, but the miners are only up 2% or something. They are stocks, after all. You know, they are kind of salmon swimming against the stream to some extent.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, falling stock market tends to drag everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the equities down here.
I do have one more question in queue, so anybody else that wants to add a question to Chris, this is about your last chance, and you're being very generous with your time, and I very much appreciate it, so I don't want to keep you all day, though, either. This one comes from Michael, and this draws upon some of your other levels of expertise. What folks may or may not know, besides being an MBA, Chris also has a PhD from Duke in neurotoxicology, right?
That's it.
And does that make you a Dukie?
It does.
It does? Okay. Just want to make sure I know where we stand. Okay. You and Christian Leitner, I guess. Okay. Michael's question is, if you're continuing to pay attention to, and I assume you are, what's going on in Fukushima here 4 years on. Currently, are you concerned with the stories that seem to seep out, like the radioactive seawater, or do you think, I mean, we'll just leave it there. What are your current thoughts?
It's absolutely a disaster. It's continuing to unfold. It's something that I wrote extensively about at the time it was happening, and I haven't written a lot about it recently, but I probably should because, you know, way back when, at the time, by within a month in 2011, I had already determined that we'd had meltdowns and that that a lot of the corium cores were missing.
Yep.
And that's still true today. So they still know where the cores are, right? You know, they've gone AWOL, right? And they still can't get robots into the dead center to really see what's going on. And now, you know, slowly things have leaked out. Like, you know, they found particles, like measurable particles, whole microns in size, upwards of 30, 40 miles away. Which, if you remember, Reactor 3 was the one that really blew. Like, that one looked like a shotgun being shot in a little tube, right? And people are like, oh, a hydrogen explosion. Like, no way, dude. That was an exothermic explosion of some kind, but it wasn't hydrogen, right? And I'm convinced that what happened was that they had an actual full-on explosive event, some kind, in the primary reactor pressure vessel. And that's shaped like a shotgun shell, and it clearly blew stuff straight up in the atmosphere, and they found particles 30 miles away.
Oh,
so what happened there was nothing short of a full-blown disaster. We had explosive events. We had meltdowns. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. We now know that almost all of the radioactivity that was in pool number 4, a big chunk of it just burned and went off, you know, went on walkabout. So that's really bad, and we know that what radioactivity is there is still leaking into the ocean, not in decreasing amounts, but in increasing amounts. The levels of readings they've been getting off of there, you know, in the billions of becquerels, sometimes, you know, you have to go to the trillions. It's just astonishing amounts of radioactivity leaking into the ocean. And so, you know, my advice at the time, and would still be true, is anybody living 100 kilometers up or down the coast from that needs to move at least 2 kilometers inland, because what happens is those radioactive isotopes, they combine with the water, they get into the mud, and at low tide they volatilize. This is what we learned in Ireland from people who got very excessive cancer cases who were living near the coast, near a reprocessing facility in Ireland, was that once that stuff gets out into the ocean, it doesn't just go away like they hoped. It somehow drifts back inland, and everybody who's you know, that wonderful sea air smell you get when you get close to the ocean,
yeah,
right? Yeah, you want to avoid that at all costs if you're living in Japan. And, you know, but Japan's trying, their government's absolutely lying about it, and they're doing everything they can to minimize it. They've even tried to, like, pretend it's nothing by opening up vegetable production in Fukushima and allowing those vegetables to be grown and sold, and also blocking people from talking about where those vegetables came from because they don't want anybody to know that stuff. So I know people who, you know, have radiation detectors as part of their life over there now. They use them when they go shopping. They use them to decide if they're going to put their blanket down at a given spot. It's just, it's not a great situation, and it's a very bad sort of a situation. Unfortunately, it's not going to be over for another 2 or 3 decades, if over is even the right word to use.
You mentioned it getting worse. How, I speculate, if you would, Chris, how much worse? What does that mean? I mean, what? How much more environmental damage could it become a real threat to people outside of that little 100-kilometer ring?
Well, yeah, I'm not as worried about the overall ocean effects, and, you know, we've detected very, very minor amounts over here, and those don't worry me at all. So radiation itself doesn't worry me. Contamination worries me a lot, and the difference is radiation is something we live with all the time. Like, if you measured your body right now, the potassium that's in your body, the K stands for potassium in this element chart, right? The K40, which is the isotope that's radioactive, you're actually pretty hot right now. You know, all of us are, because we have this in our bodies. So we live with that sort of radiation all the time. Contamination is different. That's when you get a little particle that's really hot and it's very concentrated, and that sets somewhere up in your lung, or you've eaten it and it sets up next to some part in your intestine. If you get those sorts of contamination particles in you, now you have a big, big health crisis that I think is much worse than just general radioactivity. And what's happened in Fukushima is they've got a lot of contamination over there. And I think that part could get worse. It's been a number of years, so maybe the cores have all cooled down enough that nothing's going to happen. But I do worry that they might have another explosive event. Maybe those cores finally you know, hit water, or something happens, or they reconfigure themselves. I don't know what could happen, but if there is another sort of explosive event over there, I can see it being very bad. And I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it's just a measure of the fact that we still don't know where most of the radioactive stuff is. And if they do know, they haven't told anybody, but I assume if they found it, they would let us know, because that would be, they'd be very proud of that. Hey, we found it. It's over here. They don't know. And so that's obviously a cause for concern. But if I was living over there, there's not a chance in the world I would expose myself to the contamination that's over there, which are the dust particles, microscopic particles that are floating around that are hot as hell.
Ugh. All right. Like I said, you're being very generous with your time. You mind if I ask you one last question that just came in here while you were answering the last one?
Yeah, something more upbeat than Fukushima. Yeah, I'm really sorry. That place bums me out.
All right. The last question I'll offer you then, before we get to the final four, comes from Deb, who just wants to know if you think investing in water is a wise move. Didn't Michael Burry say that that's his next thing that he's been investing in for the last 4 or 5 years? If so, if you do think that's a wise move, what are your considerations? Where do you look for possible opportunities?
Well, obviously it's going to be an incredibly good move. It's a tricky thing to really invest in. Because water rights are amongst the most contentious out there. So it's not easy. It's like saying farmland, great investment, but very hard to find vehicles that are that make a lot of sense. So, you know, the ways you can is you can invest in water utilities themselves, trusting that they're going to be able to raise prices faster than their input costs go up. You could invest in the companies that manufacture the desalination plant components, because those are really taking off. And, you know, Saudi Arabia, bless their hearts, decided in the early 80s it was going to be a great idea to take their only aquifer and grow wheat in the desert with it, and now they're out of water. Go figure, right?
Brilliant.
And, that was brilliant. You know, that water was laid down in the last glaciation period, so they have to wait for the next glacial period to get that thing recharged. Be a little wait. In the meantime, they're going to take their energy and use and convert that into desalination water plant output. So I think that area is going to be really big. And, of course, any of the technology plays that are going to be helping people to use water more efficiently is going to be a really big deal as well. So to invest in the water itself is really tricky because of how the rights are usually managed and all of that. Not impossible, but it's hard, and it's particularly hard for non-accredited small investors to play in that, because the big private money sort of already got, they're already up the curve on that. But you can look at all the companies that are out there that are going to help us either desalinate and or use water a lot more efficiently, because we're learning all the time how to use water a lot more efficiently for agriculture and for power production and for commercial uses. And surprisingly, residential uses is actually a very small component of the overall use pattern for water across the world.
Yeah. All you got to do is go to Las Vegas. You see that.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's raining out there this week, but just barely providing a dent. Hopefully, it'll continue. Chris, thank you so much for your time. I want to wrap up with the final four. You know, just kind of a tradition around here. Just four quick questions as we go out. You usually answer with a one word or maybe a quick sentence. Let everybody get to know you a little bit better. If you're ready, I'll lay them on you.
All right, let's do it.
All right, number one, who is the next president of the United States?
None of the above. If I have my way, I hate to say this, I really do. I don't do politics, but it looks to me like the machine is doing everything it can to push Hillary at us. Despite obvious criminal charges that should be levied against her and other things, despite the fact that Bernie Sanders is way ahead of her in several polls, she's being presented as the obvious front runner, and I just can't see the Donald making it all the way to the goal line, sooner or later the media will turn on him and do what they always do, destroy one candidate to anoint another. So when I answer the question, it's based on what I think the machine is going to do in terms of promoting one and minimizing the other candidates. And it feels to me right now like that Hillary's got that anointment from whatever power structure does these things.
Well put. All right, number two, you may remember about 2 years ago, I reached out to you because I was planning to take Mrs. F and the LTs out to the islands of Hawaii for a vacation over spring break. And I said, Chris, is it okay to eat the fish they catch out there? And you said, you kind of almost giggled at me and said, yes, it's just fine. Don't worry, because you've just been there. All right, but we just were talking about Fukushima. So there you go. Is it still okay to eat fish the next time I go to Hawaii?
Absolutely. Okay. I wouldn't worry about it even a little bit.
Okay, cross that one off. All right, number three, what happens first? Not necessarily in 2016, just looking out. What happens first? A dissolution of the euro or China instituting a gold-backed yuan? Or neither, I guess.
Ooh, which comes first in that? The euro would obviously fall apart first. The machine is going to do everything in its power to fight any currency becoming gold-backed. That's absolutely anathema to everything that the main central banks of the world have been working for a long time. They will only do that under severe duress. Look at the last country. The closest country that got to this was Libya with the gold dinar. And Gaddafi did a wonderful job of actually lining up lots of African support for that idea. And next thing you know, NATO executed him, took him out.
Did you see the emails? Did you see that was released on New Year's Eve? I just was writing about that today. Have you seen those?
You know what? I have a tab open to look at that. I saw that, caught my eye, but I haven't read it yet.
It's jaw-dropping. It's released emails from Sid Blumenthal to Hillary Clinton laying out that's exactly the rationale that the French had, that's why they were pushing it, was to not only confiscate the gold, which is now gone, but to keep Gaddafi from offering this new gold-backed currency. It's in the emails from Sid Blumenthal to Hillary. So there you go.
Oh, that's so maddening. Oh, my gosh. That's psychopathic.
I was ready to just write about everything going on in the world, and then I saw that and had to drop everything and write about that story instead because, it's like all the people that have died, not only soldiers on the ground from the West that it's our next patriotic war, but the refugee crisis and the people that have drowned trying to get out of Libya, and it's a failed state and all that stuff. Yeah, it's enough to really make you. What it will make you, but yeah, it'll be maddening when you see it. Finally, the fourth question. I think you addressed this one too over the course of the call, but I'll ask you. If I handed you 1,100 Federal Reserve notes over lunch here after this call, and you had to go across the street to buy either 1 ounce of gold or 75 ounces of silver, which would you buy?
I'm buying the silver.
What I thought is, like you said, just keep stacking. If you're going to have anything to hand over to posterity, if that's what it becomes, if that's ultimately what it becomes.
Yep, I'm still a net accumulator. I've been accumulating since 2002, I didn't do a lot of accumulating. I did none between 2010 and 2015, but in 2015 I started buying both gold and silver.
Let me just ask you real quick, bullion mainly, or do you buy coins? Do you have a preferred method, or do you just kind of spread it out?
I did the whole 100-ounce bar thing for a long time. Now I really heavily prefer the coins, yeah. Bullion coins, 1-ounce coins for silver and a variety of things for gold, but really sticking to the basics.
Fungible, as they would say, down there at the 1 ounce. That's something you can actually get some mileage out of if everything falls apart too, obviously.
Yep.
Chris, thank you. Again, tell everybody as we wrap what happens at peak prosperity, how that works, and then remind everybody again about the quality of your book.
All right. Well, peak prosperity is main website. Adam and I, we run it. We have a lot of articles there. We're tracking what's going on in the world, and we have a subscription service for people who like to go a little bit deeper. So, we'll offer a lot of 90% of our content is free, and many times it's fairly detailed. But if you really want to go the extra mile, that's what the subscription service is for. I'm constantly tracking the world. I never sleep, it seems. I'm always figuring out what's going on and just trying to let people know where we are in this story. That's the service. And so I track everything from geopolitics to gold to silver to markets. Doesn't matter. Whatever's relevant and potentially going to move things that are important for people to know about. So we have an alert service if anything really breaks and things like that. So that's at Peak Prosperity. And then Prosper, the book getting great reviews, it's really important. It's a wonderful summary of years and years of trying to answer that question, what should I do? So it provides great framing for people who are trying to understand what the next thing would be. And here's part of who we wrote it for. wrote it specifically for if people who want to give it to somebody else,
right,
who maybe
right.
isn't up the curve yet, who doesn't really know the whole story, but they're a little worried. They're, you know, they're ready. They're not totally in denial, but they haven't quite crossed all the way over into understanding how the world works. This is a great book to give to people like that. You know, if you read it, you'll see that it's been, you know, it's not full of greed and fear and emotions. It's very contained, and we don't pull punches, but at the same time, you know, it's very methodical and rational and calm. So that's what I love the reviews we're getting, is people saying, wow, this really worked. I gave it to somebody who I thought would be not receptive, but the way this was written, it got to them, and now we're having conversations.
That was exactly the last thing I was going to say, is don't just buy one copy, buy two, one for yourself and one to give away to someone. You know, I think that'd be about the best thing someone can do as a late Christmas present. Chris, thank you. We ran a little over time, and you very generously hung around and answered all of our questions. I really, really appreciate it. I want to wish you the best in 2016, some peak prosperity for yourself, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again sometime soon.
Fantastic. It's been a real pleasure for me, and I hope we can do it again.
All right, my friend. All the best.